St. Peter's Basilica. St. Peter's is the greatest church in Christendom. Built on the memory and grave of the first pope, St. Peter, this is where the grandeur of ancient Rome became the grandeur of Christianity. Hi, I'm Rick Steves. Thanks for joining me on a walk through St. Peter's Basilica. We'll see the spacious square, the cavernous interior, the places where Peter was crucified and buried, and Michelangelo's Pietà. We'll peek at where the Pope lives and talk about the Vatican today. Be aware that there's a strictly enforced dress code to get into St. Peter's. Basically, no shorts or bare shoulders allowed. And unless you arrive very early or late in the day, long security lines can be a problem. So consult a guidebook to plan your visit. Allow about 90 minutes for a walk through this living symbol of global Catholicism, all under the watchful presence of Michelangelo's magnificent dome. To help us along the way, I've invited a good friend and virtual travel buddy. Welcome, Lisa.
Hi, Rick.
Lisa will give us helpful directions and sightseeing tips throughout the tour.
And my first tip is to be sure you get our tour updates. Just press the icon at the lower right of your device. You'll find any updates and helpful instructions unique to this tour.
Things like closures, opening hours, and reservation requirements.
There's also tips on how to use this audio tour and even the full printed script.
Yes, so pause for just a moment right now to review our updates and special tips.
It's okay, we'll wait.
And now, let's get ready to enter the majestic and historic church that is St. Peter's Basilica. The tour begins. The origins of old and new St. Peter's.
Start at St. Peter's Square, the spacious, oval-shaped piazza in front of the church. Find a shady spot under the columns where you like the view. Grab a seat.
If the pigeons left you a clean spot.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. The tourist information office is to the left of the church, and WCs are to the left and right. Check out the length of the line to get into the church. There's a metal detector, a dress code assessment, and a mandatory and free baggage check. If the line looks long, consider getting into it now. The first 10 minutes or so of this audio tour describes sights outside the church, many of them visible even if you're standing in line. But if the line is manageable, take a seat under the columns. Survey the square from there. The church, the dome, the statues, the crowds of pilgrims. While Rick sets the scene. Rick?
Old and new St. Peter's. Nearly 2,000 years ago, this area was the site of Nero's Circus, a huge cigar-shaped Roman chariot race course. Think Ben-Hur. The tall obelisk you see in the middle of the square was the centerpiece of Nero's racetrack. Imagine the chariots doing laps around it. The Romans had no marching bands, so for halftime entertainment, they killed Christians. This persecuted minority was forced to fight wild animals and gladiators, or they were simply crucified. Some were tarred up, tied to posts, and burned, human torches to light up the evening races. Many believe that one of those killed here in about 65 AD was Peter, Jesus' right-hand man. There's a large statue of Peter in front of the church. Of the two statues, he's the one on the left holding the keys. According to early accounts, Peter had come to Rome to spread Jesus' message of love, but his outspoken practice of a forbidden religion landed him here. At his own request, Peter was crucified upside down, because he felt unworthy to die as his master did. After the crowds dispersed, his friends buried his remains in a nearby cemetery on what was called the Vatican Hill. For 250 years, these relics were quietly and secretly revered. The altar and dome of today's massive basilica mark that exact spot of Peter's grave. Peter had been recognized as the first pope or bishop of Rome, from whom all later popes claimed their authority as head of the church. When Christianity was finally legalized in 313, the Christian emperor Constantine built a church here on the site of St. Peter's martyrdom. This earlier church, now known as Old St. Peter's, lasted 1,200 years. By the year 1500, the time of the Renaissance, Old St. Peter's was falling apart and considered unfit to be the center of the Western Church. Pope Julius II, the same man who hired Michelangelo to do the Sistine ceiling, laid the cornerstone in 1506 for a brand new church to be built by the architect Bramante. He was succeeded by a number of other architects, each with his own designs, including Michelangelo, who began the magnificent dome. 120 years later, the church we see today was finally dedicated. Today, only a few columns and statues remain from that first church. Michelangelo's soaring dome is partially obscured by the facade of the church. It wasn't until the 1930s that Benito Mussolini opened up the broad boulevard leading up to the square, finally letting people get a good view of the dome. Though I don't make a habit of thanking fascist dictators, in this case, I'll make an exception. Grazie, Benito.
More on the church later. For now, let's talk about the square. Ideally, you should head out to the obelisk, the column in the middle of the square, for the best view. But let me guess, it's 95 degrees out, right? Okay, then listen on in the shade of these stone sequoias.
St. Peter's Square. St. Peter's Square, with its ring of columns, symbolizes the arms of the church welcoming everyone, believers and non-believers, with its motherly embrace. It was designed a century after Michelangelo in the mid-1600s by the Baroque architect Gian Lorenzo Bernini. Bernini also did much of the work that we'll see inside. Some numbers first. There are 284 columns, each 56 feet high. They're in the stern Doric style. Topping them are Bernini's 140 favorite saints, each 10 feet tall. The so-called square is actually elliptical. It's 650 feet by 500 feet. It's designed like a saucer, a little higher around the edges, so that even when full of crowds, and it often is, it lets those on the periphery see above the throngs. The obelisk in the center is 90 feet of solid granite, weighing more than 300 tons. Obelisks, four-sided columns that taper to a pyramid, were Egyptian symbols of their sun god. Romans decorated the city with these to underscore how they'd triumphed over the enlightened Egyptians. Think for a second how much history this obelisk has seen. Erected originally in Egypt more than 2,000 years ago, it witnessed the fall of the pharaohs to the Greeks and then to the Romans. It was then moved to Imperial Rome by the Emperor Caligula, where it stood impassively watching the slaughter of Christians here at Nero's racecourse. In later years, it oversaw the torture of Protestants by the Inquisition. That was in the yellow and rust building just outside the square to the left of the church. Today, it watches over Piazza San Pietro. The puny cross on top reminds us that each civilization builds upon previous ones. Here we see our Christian culture is but a thin veneer over our pagan roots.
Now, venture out across the square to the obelisk, which provides a narrow sliver of shade and a drinking fountain oasis. As you walk, let Rick point out some sights about the Vatican's best-known resident.
The Pope's World. The Vatican is the home of the Pope, and St. Peter's is where so many important events take place. Let's find a few of the sites that appear regularly on the evening news. First, face the church and find the balcony in the middle of the facade. It's the one over the central doorway. This is where the Pope appears on formal occasions like Christmas or Easter. He pronounces a blessing in Latin to the Urbi et Orbi, to the city and the world. Now, facing the church, pan to the right and find the gray building, the one at 2 o'clock, rising up behind Bernini's colonnade. That's the Pope's official residence. His suite of rooms is on the top floor. The last window on the right is his bedroom. To the left of that window is the window of his study. It's from that window that the Pope often appears to greet the masses, usually Sundays at noon. On those days, the study window is draped with a long banner. The windows open, and the Pope waves to the faithful assembled below in this square. Then he gives a short sermon, says a traditional prayer in Latin called the Angelus, and blesses the crowds with a wave of his hand. The whole thing lasts about 15 minutes. If you want to see it, you don't need a ticket. Just show up at the square. The Pope also gives audiences on Wednesday mornings. These take place right here in the square. Chairs are set up for thousands of spectators. Then the Pope rides in on his Popemobile. He weaves through the adoring crowds and makes his way up to the stage. The stage is set up right in front of the church, on top of the steps. From there, the Pope gives a short sermon and blessing. To get a seat for this appearance, you must have an advance ticket, but they're free and easy to get. Just consult a guidebook for details. Now find the Sistine Chapel. It's just to the right of the church's facade. The small gray-brown building with the triangular roof topped by an antenna. Look close. That tiny pimple along the roofline midway up the left side is a chimney. That's where the famous smoke signals announce the election of each new pope. With these places in mind, picture the scene when a new pope is selected. When a pope dies or retires, the tiny, peaceful Vatican stirs from its timeless slumber and becomes headline news. St. Peter's becomes ground zero as the focus of the world's attention. Millions of people converge on Vatican City, and hundreds of millions across the globe follow it on TV. The deceased pope's body is displayed in state inside St. Peter's Basilica. Thousands of pilgrims line up here on the square, waiting for one last look at their pope. The line often stretches all the way down Via della Conciliazione. On the day of the funeral, hundreds of thousands of mourners and dignitaries gather in the square. The Pope's coffin is carried out to the square, where a eulogy is given. Most popes are laid to rest in the crypt below St. Peter's Basilica, near the tomb of St. Peter and other popes. Especially popular popes, such as St. John Paul II or John the 23rd, eventually find a place upstairs, inside St. Peter's itself. After the funeral, the attention shifts to the Sistine Chapel. Over 100 cardinals who represent Catholics all around the globe descend on Rome to elect a new pope. The crimson-robed cardinals are stripped of their mobile phones, given a vow of secrecy, and locked inside the Sistine Chapel. This begins the conclave, from the Latin cum clave, with key. Meanwhile, outside, people assemble in the square and keep an eye on that famous chimney. As the cardinals cast votes, their ballots are burned in a stove inside the chapel. The smoke rises up and out the tiny chimney. Black smoke means they've yet to agree on a new pope. Finally, the anxious crowd looks up and sees a puff of white smoke emerging from the chapel. The bells in St. Peter's clock tower ring out gloriously. The crowd cheers, and Romans watching on TV hail taxis to hurry to the square. Then comes the official announcement from the balcony of St. Peter's. The newly elected pope steps up and raises his hands as thousands chant, "Viva il Papa!" A cardinal introduces him to the crowd, announcing his newly chosen name. "Brothers and sisters," the cardinal says in Latin, "Habemus Papam, we have a pope."
"Well, Habemus Churchum, we have a church to visit. Let's start heading inside St. Peter's." From the obelisk, walk directly to the right, stepping over 5 plaques in the pavement. Stop at the plaque marked Centro del Colonnato. From here, all of Bernini's columns on the right side line up. Pretty nifty. The curved Baroque square still pays its respects to Renaissance mathematical symmetry. Now let's approach the church. If you're not already in the security line, join it now. Start climbing the gradually sloping pavement past the crowd barriers, the security checkpoint, and the huge statues of St. Paul, with his two-edged sword, and St. Peter, with his bushy hair and keys. Along the way, let Rick tell you a bit more about the Vatican today.
Vatican City. Vatican City is an independent country consisting of about 100 acres. Most of it lies behind and to the right of St. Peter's. On the square are 2 entrances to Vatican City, one to the left of the church's facade and one to the right. Guarding these border crossings are mercenary guards from Switzerland. While their colorful uniforms were designed in the 20th century, they were inspired by the style worn by mercenary troops back in the 1500s when the Guard was founded. The blue, red, and yellow colors were the colors of the Medici family, from where four popes of that day came. The tiny, powerful Vatican has its own security force, helipad, and mini train station. Its version of the euro coin has a picture of the Pope on it. They're so rare they're snatched up right from the mint by collectors. The Vatican also has its own radio station.
You're listening to KPOP.
Ha ha, very funny.
No, seriously, really.
Really?
Yeah, it's an oldie station.
K-Pope?
Okay, it's not called K-Pope, but there is a Vatican station, and it does play oldies. You know, Bach, Beethoven, Mozart.
Ah, the true oldies.
The Vatican also has its own postal service and stamps. In fact, there's a post office just to the left of the church.
Keep making your way to the church entrance.
The Pope is both the religious and secular leader of Vatican City. For centuries, locals referred to him as King Pope. Italy and the Vatican didn't always have good relations. While Italy was unified in 1870, the Pope didn't recognize Italy as a country until 1929, when the Pope and Mussolini finally signed the Lateran Pact. This treaty agreed that the Vatican was an independent nation, including a few extra territories which were outlying churches. Small but politically powerful, the Vatican is the religious capital of over a billion Roman Catholics. If you're a Protestant, check your Reformation sword at the door. Atheists, suspend your disbelief. Things are much more enjoyable here if you become a temporary Catholic, if only for your visit. Seriously, your time in St. Peter's can be an awe-inspiring and beautiful experience regardless of your faith, or lack of faith, if you accept and respect things on Catholic terms as you visit.
As you emerge from the security check, you'll pass by the dress code enforcers and a gaggle of ticked-off guys in shorts. Climb the church steps and go inside. If you're not there yet, pause the audio guide, and we'll meet you inside the church in the entrance hall or atrium.
The Atrium. By now, you should be inside St. Peter's, in the entrance hall. This entrance hall is itself bigger than most churches. From here, five famous bronze doors lead into the main church. Take a close look at the central door. Made from the melted-down bronze of the original door of Old St. Peter's, it dates from around 1450 and is considered the first Renaissance work in Rome. It's only opened on special occasions. The panels feature Jesus and Mary at the top, Paul and Peter in the middle, and at the bottom, how those saints were martyred. Paul was decapitated, and Peter was crucified upside down. Now walk to the right. The far right entrance is the Holy Door, opened only during holy years. Every 25 years, on Christmas Eve, the Pope knocks three times with a silver hammer and the door opens, welcoming pilgrims to pass through. For Holy Year 2000, Pope John Paul II opened this door on Christmas Eve and bricked it up again with a ceremonial trowel a year later, to wait another 24 years. Above the door is a commemorative plaque that says that Pope Ioannis Paulus II opened the door in the year MM, that's 2000, and closed it in MM1. Although holy years officially come every 25 years, Pope Francis declared the year 2016 as an extraordinary Jubilee of Mercy holy year. So this holy door was once again prepared to welcome an extraordinary horde of pilgrims.
Now let's enter the church. Join the flow of crowds and prepare for one of Europe's great wow experiences.
Even after dozens of visits, I still get a thrill.
Once inside, do your best to peel off from the crowds. Find a place with a good view straight down the long nave or central hallway.
The Nave. Wow, the church is huge. Stand at the very back of the nave and survey the heavenly expanse. It's a riot of marble, gold, stucco, mosaics, columns of stone, and pillars of light. As the symbol of global Catholicism, this church is appropriately big. Size before beauty. The golden window at the far end is 2 football fields away. The dove in that window is wider than you are tall. The bronze canopy over the altar is 7 stories tall. The church covers 6 acres. Look at the pillars that line the main hall. Those statues of babies at the base are adult size. Overhead, the lettering in the gold band along the top of the pillars is 7 feet high. This church has a capacity of 60,000 standing worshipers. That's the equivalent of 1,200 tour groups. I've lost entire groups in here. Birds fly around and hardly know they're inside. The church is huge, and it feels huge, but everything's designed to make it seem smaller and more intimate than it really is. For example, if you look at the first pillar on the right, the statue of St. Teresa near the bottom is 15 feet tall. The statue above her near the top of the pillar looks the same size, but it's actually 6 feet taller, giving the impression that it's not so far away. Similarly, the fancy bronze canopy over the altar makes the great height of the dome seem smaller. Looking down the nave, think of all the history. First, we get a sense of the splendor of ancient Rome that was carried on by the Catholic Church. For instance, the floor plan is based on the ancient Roman basilica or law court building, with a central aisle or nave flanked by 2 side aisles. In fact, many of the stones used to build St. Peter's were scavenged from the ruined law courts of ancient Rome. Look around on the floor near the central doorway. Find a round purple slab of porphyry stone, the color of ancient Roman officials. Stand on it. This is the spot in Old St. Peter's where, on Christmas night in the year 800, the Pope crowned the French King Charlemagne Holy Roman Emperor. Even in the Dark Ages, when Rome was virtually abandoned and visitors reported that the city had more thieves and wolves than decent people, its imperial legacy made it a fitting place to symbolically establish a briefly united Europe. During the Renaissance, New St. Peter's was very expensive to build and decorate. The popes financed it by selling indulgences. These allowed Europe's rich to buy forgiveness for their sins. This kind of corruption inspired an obscure German monk named Martin Luther to rebel and start the Protestant Reformation. In response, St. Peter's became a symbol of the Catholic Counter-Reformation. Its ornate Baroque-style interior served as propaganda, impressing followers with the authority of the church and giving them a glimpse of the heaven that awaited the faithful, the obedient, and the generous.
Rick, you checked your Protestant sword at the door, remember?
Oops. I'm sorry. Please forgive me.
Now gape up for a while at your surroundings.
But remember those birds, so try to gape with your mouth closed. And don't gape yet at Michelangelo's famous Pietà over on the right. That's this tour's finale.
Now start walking straight up the center of the nave toward the altar, topped with the big bronze canopy.
As you go, you may notice plaques in the floor running straight up the center of the nave. These show where the next biggest churches of the world would end if they were placed inside St. Peter's. You'll pass by St. Paul's Cathedral in so-called Londinense, or London. Next comes the Duomo in Firenze, or Florence, and so on. Some argue that the world's largest Christian church is no longer St. Peter's, but one built in 1989 in Ivory Coast, Africa. But St. Peter's is certainly the richest and most magnificent.
Keep making your way up the nave.
As you walk, think about the thousands upon thousands of man-hours it took to build this enormous structure. All in all, it was under construction for 120 years, from 1506 until 1626. One of its architects was the great Michelangelo, who topped it with a dome.
And the dome should now be coming into view. As soon as it does, where the nave starts to reach the altar area, stop. There's a lot to absorb here. The dome, the bronze canopy, and the altar.
Stand here and look all around at this huge expanse.
Michelangelo's Church. Standing here at the heart of the church is a good place to talk about the church's architectural footprint. The church took 120 years to build, and the blueprint changed and evolved with each generation. The first architect, Donato Bramante, intended the church to have four equal-length arms, each radiating out from the altar. But after Bramante died, the project languished for decades. In 1546, Michelangelo was 71 years old when the Pope persuaded him to take over the unfinished church project and cap it with a dome. He'd already proven himself as a sculptor, doing the Pietà for Old St. Peter's, and as a painter in the Sistine Chapel. For this Renaissance man, architecture was the next step. Michelangelo's plan was to put a grand dome over Bramante's original Greek cross floor plan. In optimistic Renaissance times, this symmetrical arrangement symbolized perfection, both the orderliness of the created world and the goodness of man, who, after all, was created in God's image. Michelangelo agreed to take over the project on three terms: that he would not be paid, that he would be given an army of workers to get as much completed in his remaining years as possible, and that the original Greek cross plan would be honored. But after his death, the church, struggling against Protestants, opted for a different plan designed to impress the world with its grandeur. The architect Maderno doubled the size of the nave so twice as many people could take part in the over-the-top religious spectacles of the Baroque period. Look back on how long that nave is today, dwarfing almost every other church in the world. If Michelangelo had had his way, the church would have looked quite different today.
Now, turn your attention to Michelangelo's main contribution to the church, the dome overhead. A good place to see it is from the statue of St. Andrew to the left of the altar. He's the guy holding an X-shaped cross. Park yourself in front of that statue. Like Andrew, gaze up into the dome, and also like him, gasp.
Never stifle a gasp. Michelangelo's Dome. The dome soars higher than a football field on end, 430 feet from the floor of the cathedral to the top of the lantern. It glows with light from its windows, and the blue and gold mosaics create a cool, solemn atmosphere. In this majestic vision of heaven, which, by the way, was not painted by Michelangelo, we see Jesus, Mary, and saints. They're in the ring just above the windows. Rising above them are more rings of angels, and way up in the ozone, that's God the Father. Without binoculars, he's just a blur of blue and red. Michelangelo began work on the dome in 1546. When he died, nearly 20 years later, he'd completed only the drum of the dome. That's the cylindrical base, up to the windows flanked by half columns. The next generation of architects completed Michelangelo's vision, guided carefully by his blueprints. Standing under the dome, listen to the hum of visitors echoing through St. Peter's and reflect on our place in the cosmos. Half animal, half angel, stretched between heaven and earth, born to live only a short while. A bubble of foam on a great cresting wave of humanity.
Rick?
But I digress.
Under the dome is the main altar, covered with the large bronze canopy. You're right at ground zero for the story of the man called Peter.
Peter's tomb. Peter, the disciple of Jesus who brought Christianity to Rome, lies buried directly beneath the altar. Although the actual tomb is not visible, there are lots of reminders of Peter all around you. Start by looking back up at the dome. The base of the dome is ringed with a gold banner telling us in massive blue letters why this church is so important. According to Catholics, Peter was selected by Jesus to head the church. The banner in Latin quotes from the Bible where Jesus says to him, "Tu es Petrus, you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and to you I will give the keys of the kingdom of heaven." That's Matthew 16:18. In fact, every quote from Jesus to Peter found in the Bible is written out in 7-foot-tall letters that continue around the entire church. Peter was the first bishop of Rome. His prestige, and that of the city itself, made this bishopric more illustrious than all others. And Peter's authority has supposedly passed in an unbroken chain to each succeeding bishop of Rome. That is, the 250 or so popes that followed.
Now approach the altar for a closer look. Belly up to the stone railing that extends out from the altar.
Under the dome, under the bronze canopy, under the altar, and some 23 feet under the church's marble floor, rest the bones of St. Peter, the rock upon which this particular church was built. You can't see the actual tomb, but go to the railing and look down into the small lighted niche below the altar. There you'll see a box containing bishop's shawls, a symbol of how Peter's authority spread to the other churches. Peter's tomb, though not visible, is just below this box. You can't visit Peter's tomb unless you book a special tour months in advance. Does the tomb really contain the bones of Jesus' apostle? According to a papal pronouncement, definitely maybe. The traditional site of this tomb was sealed up when Old St. Peter's was built on it in the year 326. It remained sealed until 1940 when it was opened for archaeological study. Bones were found, dated from the first century, of a robust man who died in old age. His body was wrapped in expensive cloth. Various inscriptions and graffiti in the tomb indicate that 2nd and 3rd century visitors thought this was Peter's tomb. Does that mean it's really Peter? Who am I to disagree with the Pope? Definitely, maybe. Look closely at the niche. If you line up the lighted niche with the cross on the altar and with the dove in the window, you'll notice that the niche is just off-center compared to the rest of the church. Why? Because Michelangelo built the church around the traditional location of the tomb, not the actual location, about 2 feet away, discovered by modern archaeology. I say, close enough.
Since we're on the subject of Peter, stroll back into the nave, where you'll find a bronze statue of Peter, seated, with a canopy over his head.
The Statue of Peter. This bronze statue of Peter is one of only a handful of pieces of art that was in the earlier church. In one hand, he holds the keys, the symbol of the authority given him by Christ, while with the other hand, he blesses us. Peter's wearing the toga of a Roman senator. It may be that the original statue actually was of a senator, and that the head and keys were added later to make it Peter. Regardless, most subsequent paintings and statues of Peter have these same motifs: keys, beard, curly hair, and strong build. According to the Bible, Peter was a fisherman who was chosen by Christ to catch sinners instead. Peter had human weaknesses that endeared him to Christians. He was the one who tried to walk on water but failed. He impetuously cut off a man's ear when the soldiers came to arrest Christ, and he even denied knowing Jesus to save his own skin. But Jesus chose him anyway to be his rock. The name Peter is a nickname that means rock. After Jesus' death, legends say Peter came to the wicked city of Rome to spread the gospel of love. He may have been imprisoned in the Mamertine prison near the Forum. And stories say he had a vision of Christ along the Appian Way, Quo Vadis and all that. Eventually, Peter's preaching offended the authorities, and he was arrested, crucified by Nero, and buried here. You'll notice that the statue's big right toe has been worn smooth by the lips and hands of centuries of adoring pilgrims.
Roman Catholics believe Peter was the first of a long line of popes, some reviled, some revered. Circle to the right around the statue of Peter to see another popular stop among pilgrims. You'll find a lighted glass niche with a red-robed body inside. This is one of the church's more recent popes.
Pope John the 23rd. Pope John, who reigned from 1958 to 1963, is nicknamed the Good Pope. He's best known for initiating the landmark Vatican II Council in the early 1960s that instituted major reforms. These reforms brought the Church into the modern age. That council allowed Mass to be conducted not just in traditional Latin, but in local languages that people actually spoke: English, Italian, Spanish, whatever. Also, lay people were invited to participate more in services. Church leadership underwent some healthy self-criticism, and the council championed an ecumenical spirit that reached out to Christians of Protestant faiths. Pope John was a populist, referring to people as brothers and sisters, a phrase still popular among popes today. In the year 2000, John was up for beatification, a stop on the way to sainthood. During the process, church authorities checked his body, and it was surprisingly fresh. So they moved it upstairs and put it behind glass, allowing Catholics to always remember this man known as the Good Pope. By the way, along with St. John Paul II, the Good Pope also recently became a saint, St. John the 23rd. Pope John the 23rd initiated some changes, but he was succeeded by a more traditional pope. Then came the ecumenical John Paul II, and the pendulum swung back again. With the next pope, Benedict XVI, the pendulum swung back to the conservative side. But Benedict stunned the world by taking the novel step of retiring from office rather than remaining until his death. No pope had done that for 600 years. The retirement allowed Pope Francis to succeed him, and the pendulum swung once again. Each 21st century pope has been influenced in some way by the changes introduced by Pope John the 23rd. And each walks the delicate tightrope of defending centuries-old Catholic doctrine while responding to a changing world.
Return to the main altar, which sits directly beneath the dome. The altar itself is the white marble slab with the cross and candlesticks. It's topped by the large bronze canopy, often called the baldacchino.
The main altar and Bernini's baldacchino. This main altar is used only when the Pope himself says Mass. He sometimes conducts the Sunday morning service when he's in town, an event worth experiencing. The relatively tiny altar would be lost in this enormous church if it weren't for the 7-story-tall bronze canopy, which extends the altar upward and reduces the perceived distance between floor and ceiling. The canopy was designed in the 1600s by Bernini, the Michelangelo of the Baroque era, and the man most responsible for the interior decoration of this church. Bernini's corkscrew columns echo the marble ones that once surrounded the altar in Old St. Peter's. Some of the bronze used here was taken and melted down from the ancient Pantheon. Look closer at the marble base of the columns. Focus on the column to the left of the altar. You'll see a shield with 3 bees on it. That's the symbol of the Barberini family who commissioned the work and ordered that bronze scavenging raid on the Pantheon. As the saying went, when it came to plundering the wonders of ancient Rome, what the barbarians didn't do, the Barberini did. Starting from the column to the left of the altar, begin walking clockwise right now around the canopy. At each column, notice the female faces on the marble bases, about eye level, just above the bees. Apparently, someone in the Barberini family was pregnant during the making of the canopy, and the Pope asked Bernini to chronicle the events. Follow it as you walk around the altar. The columns show the mother's face as she goes through the various stages of childbirth. It looks like it was a difficult labor. The woman almost died. Make sure you continue clockwise all the way around to the final column, and there you see how it all came out.
The suspense is killing me. If it turns out someone died, I'm going to be really bummed.
Keep the faith, Lisa, and keep going to that final column. Here it comes.
And
welcome to the world, Bambino.
Hooray!
Yahoo-hoo! Now, marvel at some other works by Bernini. The flamboyant genius remade this church, and the city for that matter, in the Baroque style. He did St. Peter's Square, of course. He also designed this entire area around the altar as a kind of theater for holy spectacles. Look around. Bernini did the bronze canopy, the stained glass dove window, plus the bronze work and statues all around it. He did one of the four statues surrounding the altar. His is the guy carrying the spear, the one singing, "The hills are alive." And he did the balconies above the four statues. These incorporate some of the actual corkscrew columns from old St. Peter's. These original corkscrew columns were said to have been looted by the Romans from the Temple of Herod in Jerusalem. All in all, at St. Peter's, Bernini gave an impressive unity to an amazing variety of pillars, windows, statues, and chapels. No wonder Bernini is called the father of Baroque.
Now, circle around behind the baldacchino to the apse.
The apse? What's an apse? I'm sorry, but I wouldn't know my apse from a hole.
Okay. It's the area of the church behind the main altar at the far end of the church. The place with the golden dove window.
The apse. Bernini's dove window shines above the smaller front altar, which is used for everyday services. The Holy Spirit, in the form of a 6-foot-high dove, pours sunlight onto the faithful through the alabaster windows. During a service, the effect is of real sunlight becoming artificial rays of gold that reflect off swirling gold clouds, angels, and winged babies. Mix in some real clouds from the incense, and this becomes the epitome of Baroque, an ornate, mixed-media ensemble designed to fill the viewer with awe. Beneath the dove is the centerpiece of this structure, the so-called Throne of Peter. Despite the name, this oak chair was actually built in medieval times for a king. Subsequently, it was encrusted with tradition and encased in bronze by Bernini as a symbol of papal authority. Statues of four early church fathers support the chair. This is symbolic of how bishops should support the Pope in troubled times, like the Counter-Reformation. Remember that St. Peter's is a church, not a museum. In the apse, Mass is said daily at 5 p.m. Pilgrims, tourists, and Roman citizens alike are welcome. Also, wooden confessional booths are available for Catholics to tell their sins to a listening ear and receive forgiveness and peace of mind. The faithful renew their faith, and the faithless gain inspiration. Look at the light streaming through the windows. Turn and gaze up into the dome, and quietly contemplate your deity, or lack of one.
Head for the south transept, the arm of the church to the left of the main altar. This transept is sometimes reserved for worshipers, so you may see a guard at the entrance to the transept. He's there to keep casual tourists out. But if you tell the guard, "I want to pray," he'll let you in. Whether you go inside the transept or just look on from a distance, focus on the alcove in the far left corner. Locate the dark painting showing St. Peter being crucified upside down.
Peter's crucifixion site. This depiction of Peter's crucifixion marks the exact spot, according to tradition, where Peter was killed, nearly 2,000 years ago. Peter had come to the world's greatest city to preach Jesus' message of love to the pagan, often hostile Romans. During the reign of Nero, he was arrested and brought here to Nero's circus so all Rome could witness his execution. When the authorities told Peter that he was to be crucified just like his Lord, Peter said, "I am not worthy," and he insisted they nail him on the cross upside down. After he was crucified on this spot, he was buried just a couple dozen yards away, where the main altar stands today. The Romans were actually quite tolerant of other religions, but they did require their conquered peoples to worship the Roman emperor as a god. For most religions, this was no problem, but monotheistic Christians refused to worship the emperor even when burned alive, crucified, or thrown to the lions. Their bravery, optimism in suffering, and message of love struck a chord among slaves and members of the lower classes. The religion, started by a poor carpenter, grew, despite occasional persecutions by fanatical emperors like Nero. In three short centuries, Christianity went from a small Jewish sect in Jerusalem to being the official religion of the world's greatest empire. By the way, this painting of Peter is not a painting at all. Smoke and humidity would damage real paintings. So, like virtually all the others in the church, it's actually a mosaic copy made from thousands of colored chips the size of your little fingernail.
Let's move on. From here, we'll be making our way back towards the entrance of the church for our final stop, Michelangelo's Pietà. Along the way, Rick will point out some other sites you may want to see on your own after this audio tour is over.
The Dome and Other Sites. As you make your way to Michelangelo's Pietà, take note of a few more sightseeing options. First, near the main altar is the entrance to the crypt beneath the church. Down in the crypt are the foundations of old St. Peter's and tombs of many popes.
But be warned, this is a one-way route that will eventually take you out of the basilica, so it's best done when you're ready to leave the building. Now, as you start heading toward the nave, just next to the south transept, you'll pass by the entrance to the museum, labeled the Tesoro.
It's on your right. It features a pope's big tomb, a big pair of ancient Roman pliers used to torture Christians,
and a forest worth of pieces of the true cross.
You'll also see assorted jewels, papal robes, and golden reliquaries.
A marked contrast to the poverty of early Christians.
Even if you don't go inside the museum itself, the passageway has some interesting tidbits. There's also a book and gift shop where you can buy stamps, and there's a handy Vatican post box.
Before moving on, check out the huge painting on the pillar facing the museum entrance.
You'll find Raphael's famous Transfiguration. Like all the other so-called paintings in the church, it's a mosaic copy of the original, which is now in the Vatican Museum.
Now, start back down the nave toward the entrance. Make your way to the left side of the nave.
On your left is the metalwork doorway of the Blessed Sacrament Chapel. You're welcome to step inside. After our tour, of course, there you'll find a surprisingly tourist-free oasis of peace reserved for prayer and meditation. A few steps further down the nave, also on the left, is a chapel with the tomb of Pope John Paul II. John Paul was the popular pope who led the church into the 21st century. He was so beloved that just 9 years after his death in 2005, he was made Saint John Paul.
Keep heading toward the Pietà.
A good way to finish a visit to St. Peter's is to go up to the dome or cupola for the best view of Rome anywhere. Allow 1 hour for the full trip up and down. The entrance moves around, but it's usually just outside the basilica on the north side of St. Peter's. An elevator takes you as far as the base of the dome, offering a great view both of the interior of the church and out overlooking the square. For some, that's plenty. For others, it's a sweaty, crowded, claustrophobic 15-minute 300-step climb up to the very top of the dome. It's well worth it. The view is great. The fresh air is even better. You'll look out over Rome, survey the Vatican grounds, and gaze down into the square on the tiny pilgrims buzzing like electrons around this nucleus of Catholicism.
By now, Michelangelo's Pietà should be coming into view. It's located near the entrance in the far left corner with your back to the altar, behind bulletproof glass.
Michelangelo's Pietà, from 1499. Michelangelo was 24 years old when he completed this Pietà of Mary with the dead body of Christ taken from the cross. It was Michelangelo's first major commission by the French ambassador to the Vatican, done for the Holy Year in 1500. Pietà means pity. In art, a Pietà always depicts Mary holding the dead body of her son Jesus. Michelangelo, with his total mastery of the real world, captures the sadness of the moment. Mary cradles her crucified son in her lap. Christ's lifeless right arm droops down, letting us know how heavy his corpse is. The smoothness of his skin is accentuated by the rough folds in Mary's robe. Mary tilts her head down, looking tenderly at her dead son. Her left hand turns upward, asking, "How could they do this to you?" Michelangelo didn't think of sculpting as creating a figure, but as simply freeing the God-made figure already in the marble. He'd launch himself into a project like this with an inspired passion, chipping away to find what God put inside. Christ's bunched-up shoulder and rigor mortis legs show that Michelangelo learned well from his studies of cadavers. But realistic as this work is, its true power lies in the subtle, unreal features. Life-size Christ looks childlike compared with larger-than-life Mary. Unnoticed at first, this makes a subconscious impression of Mary enfolding Jesus in her maternal love. Mary, the mother of a 33-year-old man, looks like a teenager, emphasizing how Mary was the eternally youthful handmaiden of the Lord, always serving him, even at this moment of supreme sacrifice. Mary always accepts God's will, even if it means giving up her son. Michelangelo's statue is a solid pyramid of maternal tenderness. Yet within this, Christ's body tilts diagonally down to the right, and Mary's hem flows with it. Subconsciously, we feel the weight of this dead God sliding from her lap to the ground. On May 23, 1972, a madman with a hammer entered St. Peter's and began hacking away at the Pietà. The damage was repaired, but that's why there's now a shield of bulletproof glass. This is Michelangelo's only signed work. The story goes that he overheard some pilgrims praising his Pietà, but saying it was done by a second-rate sculptor from a lesser city. Michelangelo was so enraged that he grabbed his chisel and chipped an inscription in the ribbon running down Mary's chest. It said, "This was made by Michelangelo Buonarroti of Florence." Turning your attention from the statue to the wall on your right, you'll see a patch of gray concrete with a gold cross. This is the inside of the holy door we saw earlier. It won't be opened until Christmas Eve 2024, the dawn of the next Jubilee year. If there's a prayer in you, ask that the next time this door is opened, St. Peter's will no longer need security checks or bulletproof glass. We hope you've enjoyed this slice of Rome. Thanks to Gene Openshaw, the co-author of this tour. If you're planning more sightseeing, we have lots of audio tours available for Rome, including A Walk Through the Heart of Rome, the Colosseum, the Roman Forum, the Pantheon, St. Peter's, the Vatican Museums and Sistine Chapel, as well as walks through Trastevere, the Jewish Ghetto, and the remains of Ostia and Pompeii.
In one day?
No. Remember, this tour was excerpted from the Rick Steves Rome Guidebook by Rick Steves and Gene Openshaw. For more details on eating, sleeping, and sightseeing in Rome, refer to the latest edition of that guidebook. For more free audio tours and podcasts, and for information about our TV shows, bus tours, and travel gear, visit our website at ricksteves.com. This tour was produced by Cedar House Audio Productions. Grazie.
Ciao.
And buon viaggio.